It's old-timey crimey.
Do you like true crime?
Do you like history?
Do you think murder's just better in black and white?
Come join us on Old-Timey Crimey, where every week we sit down and talk about a crime history forgot.
Or maybe a crime that history can't get enough of.
From the classics, like Jack the Ripper, to the crimes you may never have heard of, like the Tottenham Outrage. We dig deep into the archives to give you the details you won't get anywhere else.
And we'll probably use some filthy words in the process.
Because the good old days
weren't always so good.
New episodes every Friday, wherever you listen to podcasts.
That's Old Timey Crimey.
This episode is brought to you by the Slash and Cast Podcast Network. Learn more at slashandcast.net.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige, and in today's episode, we will be kicking off part 4 of this deep dive into the case of Kimberly Mullen's sister, Amanda Pierce. Kimberly has been through so much pain and heartache, starting with the death of her brother in 2007 after he developed a rare cancer. Then 2009, when she lost her sister Vivian and mother Rebecca by the hands of a domestic violence abuser named Damon Butler in Oklahoma. In 2015, Grayson County, Texas, her sister Amanda had established a plan with her friend Amber to pick Amanda up on the morning of May 15th. Amanda had packed her things and was ready to leave the violent relationship that she was in with Brian Espana. She told Amber on the 14th that she was sure that it would be okay to stay one more night, even though Brian said that he would choke and kill her if she was not out of the apartment by 7 p.m. that night. Sadly, Amanda was numb to his death threats and his physical abuse. Unfortunately, the night of the 14th was the night she suffered irreversible brain damage, believed to be by Brian, using a ligature to intentionally stop her breathing and blood circulation. He had done this to her so many times, except this time, she didn't wake up. She succumbed to her injuries 6 days later. Her abusive boyfriend claimed that Amanda hanged herself. His stories are ever-changing. He is the most unreliable witness, to say the least. But law enforcement took the side of a violent abuser, a liar, and a manipulator. Amanda's loved ones and people who don't even know her personally are raising their eyebrows at this story of suicide because it makes no sense. Brian's accounts of what happened seem entirely false, and how law enforcement sided with him fully instead of also taking the countless witnesses' statements into consideration, along with Brian's 10-year violent criminal record in Grayson County. There are several prior family and domestic violence-related charges that had been filed against Brian due to an assault on his ex-girlfriend Emily, as well as Amanda. The night of the incident, he had 2 outstanding warrants related to the 2014 assault mentioned in an earlier episode. There are so many details to this case, and in my opinion, and many others, none of the facts indicate that Amanda had any intention to commit suicide on May 14th, 2015. Regardless, Kimberly and Justin have been told over and over, nothing indicates homicide. Let's get into part 4. At the end of part 3, we heard Kimberly and her husband talking to the detective and Officer Smith at the Sherman Police Department. I asked you all to listen carefully to the way they said things. Just to go over a few things from the meeting, the detective said there were no bags packed, a blatant lie. Her bags were packed, and she did not own a suitcase, so the rest of her things were in trash bags. Many photos prove that, and these photos are on Instagram of the apartment and her bags. He kept trying to insist that the bag by the door, the pink bag, was a lunch bag, and even wrote in his report that Amanda's supervisor told him it was. Kimberly spoke with Amanda's supervisor shortly after this meeting and was told by the supervisor that she never said that at all. The audio from that meeting with Amanda's supervisor contradicts Detective Jones's written report. Photos taken clearly show it was not a lunch bag. Kimberly and Justin tried to understand the wounds on her neck and how they were not consistent with a hanging injury because the ligature mark was so low, below her larynx, at the base of her neck. They even told the detective and officer that the doctor did not even believe that it was from suicide. The detective could only say that Amanda did not have any defense wounds, that nothing indicated that she fought back. In my opinion, that does not prove it was suicide. Amanda had been in these situations with Brian before, and maybe she thought fighting back from previous experiences could make things even worse for her. Justin asked Detective Jones if Brian had any injuries from Amanda fighting back, and the detective indicated no. He even said that he photographed Brian for evidence. Well, guess what? Those pictures he allegedly took of Brian, there was not one photo or video of Brian submitted into evidence of those alleged pictures. Every other witness was also video recorded during their statements on the scene, but for some reason, Brian was the only one not videotaped during his statement that night. Kimberly and Justin questioned the detectives and Brian's account of how she was sitting on her knees, leaning forward into the cord. No suspension, nothing tied completely around her neck, but the ligature marks were all the way around her neck. There were no knots around her neck, only two knots very loosely tied at two different points on the clothing rod. So, how could those extensive injuries happen? All of these pictures that I talk about are on the Instagram if you would like to go look. Also, don't forget, Brian says he broke the cord of the clothing iron with his bare hands because he could not find anything to cut it with. But the cord was cut, and a box cutter was right by the clothing iron. Plus, would he not have injuries on his hands from breaking an electrical cord? It's not impossible to break one, but it would be extremely difficult and take quite a while. Longer than he claims it took just to easily get it off of her. Just for the sake of argument, unplug an electrical cord and try your best to break it with your bare hands. Men that I have talked to say it is damn near impossible to do. Either way, evidence clearly shows that it was cut, and the box cutter close by is proof. Just another one of Brian's lies. As far as the outstanding warrants, the detective claimed that he was not informed of any warrants. However, the first officer on the scene, Officer Sam Boyle, was well aware of the warrants and history of domestic violence. He is the one who called the detective in to look over the case. In addition, he offered to call Amanda's family about the incident because he knew the family and the violent history. So, essentially, the detective said Officer Boyle did not disclose this information on the scene. He even said that the warrants don't show up in county records, and that he could not just go around arresting innocent people. He even said if he were called out to a house during Thanksgiving and people had warrants or one person had punched another, that he would try not to make an arrest. Also, Kimberly can access Brian's criminal records as a citizen, but the crime investigation department cannot. Another reason that the detective said that this was most likely suicide was that there were no witnesses. But that's not true. Three people came forward and told him that she was terrified for her life and had to be out of that apartment by 7 o'clock, or Brian said specifically he would choke and kill her. One witness, Mrs. Thompson, reported the threat that very night. In the coming days, prior to Amanda being pronounced dead and the Mullins meeting at Sherman Police Department, Minnie told the detective all about the dangerous abuse Amanda endured, including strangulation incidents. There were also statements in the meeting such as, "This is not TVCSI," and "Families just can't accept suicide." Unfortunately, Kimberly and Justin started to realize this was already being treated as a suicide, and everything they said was dismissed and explained away. Kimberly said that the detective's demeanor was completely closed off, and he was not truly listening. When Kimberly asked why this could not be considered suspicious or homicide, Detective Jones responded that there was nothing indicating that she was leaving, and there were no defensive marks. So at the end of the meeting, the detective said that he would not make any final decisions until the autopsy was done. Kimberly and Justin agreed, hoping and praying the autopsy would give them the answers that they knew in their hearts, and with some basic common sense, would agree that her death was suspicious and not suicide. I am absolutely going to elaborate a lot more on this subject in part 5. There are some deep-rooted issues that I need to discuss, and you will have to wait to find out exactly what that is. All I can say right now is that it involves possible corruption in the Grayson County Police Department, as well as people who work with and around law enforcement. There is a lot that I have found, and it is wild. The next day, May 20th, 2015, the Oregon Harvest team spoke to someone at the medical examiner's office to ensure Oregon Harvest would not interfere with the autopsy. They reassured Kimberly that the Oregon Harvest would not interfere, which was good news. With the Oregon Harvest scheduled, Kimberly and the ICU nurse took detailed pictures of Amanda's now 6-day-old injuries before the heart-rending task of taking her sister off of life support. Amanda was now free of this cruel world, the pain, the violence, and she could finally have the peace that she always wanted while she was living. It is so sad and unfair that she did not get to leave that apartment, to be with her children, and experience the peace and happiness that she deserved while she was still alive. Brian Espana is to blame. From his grooming and control, to allegedly getting away with murder, at least for now. Amanda was afraid to stay, afraid to leave, and afraid to tell law enforcement. She felt anything she did would be the wrong thing to do, and Brian would not only make her pay the consequences for it, but he made sure that she knew that her kids and her family would too. That is no way for any person to live. Amanda was terrified that Brian would do something to her family. The insanity of domestic violence is the victim's stay in order to stay alive. Many times they are brainwashed to believe that staying protects their loved ones from death as well. Amanda's family now realizes that much of the reason she stayed with this evil man was to protect them. Grayson County law enforcement seems to have the general attitude of, I don't know why she didn't report it, or I don't know why people don't report these things. Education about coercive control and family violence would dispel this ignorance. Also, I want to address survivor's guilt. I believe survivor's guilt is something that is so difficult for the people going through it. You wish you could have done more to prevent the event from happening, but you must know it's not your fault, and there's nothing more that anyone could have done for Amanda, as much as you all wish you could. She was his possession, even though she did not want to be. He had the control, and she tried her hardest to escape. The many murders that have happened when someone has attempted to leave their abuser is not talked about as much as it should be. It's so important for your family to express your feelings and process your emotions. It is crucial to talk to those you trust or find an online group, for example, Facebook groups that are for people going through the same things, to connect and talk. Not everyone feels comfortable going to a counselor, but of course that is always a great option as well. You can start a grief journal. Writing is such a great outlet for many people. Also, it is vital that you remember to take care of yourself. Make sure you are getting rest, you're eating, making time for self-care. You can also start a hobby or try to focus on something that you love to do. It'll help keep your mind busy. Do not ever forget that you can handle the sadness and the unfortunate loss. You are resilient and can conquer those sad feelings. It does take time and work, but you can do it, and I believe in all of you. When you go through struggles and hardships, you come out on the other side stronger than ever before. Know that you will find joy again. Amanda would want that for all of you. The hardest part, possibly, of dealing with survivor's guilt is accepting that the truth and the answers that you so badly want may never come. You all must try your hardest not to get stuck in a hole of depression as you try to dig for understanding. Try your best not to get wrapped up in the whys and what ifs, and do what Amanda would want you to do, which is live your life to the fullest. She wanted that for herself, and she wants that for you all too. You can honor her in that way. To see her family happy is what I feel she would want. Amanda's body was transferred to the Southwest Institute of Forensic Science the evening of May 20th. On May 21st, the autopsy was performed at 10 that morning, and the death certificate was completed. Meanwhile, Kimberly and her husband Justin asked the landlord if they could collect Amanda's belongings from the apartment. The landlord said they could and told them to take everything, including Brian's personal items that he left behind when he fled, such as his computer, clothes, family letters from Guatemala, toiletries, fake immigration papers, and more. This is when Kimberly took pictures of everything in the apartment, including the closet. On May 22nd, Kimberly received a call from the funeral home in Sherman, Texas, saying that Amanda had arrived that morning. The funeral director told Kimberly that the medical examiner, Jill Urban, ruled suicide by hanging on Amanda's death certificate. Naturally, with so many suspicious details surrounding Amanda's death, Justin called Larry Atherton, the Justice of the Peace, and asked permission to speak with the medical examiner. When they got in touch with Dr. Jill Urban, Kimberly asked what determined Amanda's death suicide by hanging versus homicide by strangulation. Her answer was that Amanda did not have any defensive wounds, and her hyoid bone was intact. She went on to explain to Kimberly that when Amanda's body was brought to her, she was told that it was possible suicide by hanging. She was given no other information, details, reports, photos from the scene, the cord of the iron, or even told about the injury she sustained from Brian prior to getting the marks on her neck. Dr. Jill Urban had no idea how long Amanda had any of her injuries. From Kimberly's blog, she says, quote, "Our questions then became, how can a complete and accurate autopsy be performed when the only information provided was suicide by hanging? Wouldn't that limit your focus to one cause of death? What is the possibility that she would call the detective and say, hey, this is suspicious of homicide? Is that how forensic pathology works? I don't know, but I'm open to input." In a book by Dr. Dinesh Rao, a forensic pathologist, he explains that death due to strangulation has some general features. Evidence of violent compression or constriction of the neck during life is obtained by the presence of bruising or ecchymosis about the neck, hemorrhages in the strap muscles under the skin. Kimberly goes on to say, "All of that was present. In my opinion, it seems possible for her to have all the trauma present by her sitting on her knees, leaning forward into a cord, not tied, for less than 10 to 15 minutes per Brian. He told me he saw her sitting in the window when he drove up to the house. So with a blood alcohol of 0.384, she managed to do everything he said happened? I'm not buying it." End quote. Kimberly told Dr. Jill Urban that she had documented Amanda's wounds on May 16th and again on May 20th. She explained about Amanda's history of being a victim of domestic violence, which frequently included her being strangled. She went through so many circumstances and much of Amanda's history with Brian to paint a better picture for the medical examiner. Dr. Jill asked Kimberly to please email her the pictures that she had taken. So Kimberly sent all of the pictures and information that she had gathered within the last week. The medical examiner had no clue that Amanda's injuries were 6 days old at the time of the autopsy. Also, the multiple marks on Amanda's neck had varying degrees of intensity and levels, as well as deep muscle contusions and abrasions at the lower level of her neck, completely encircling the base. This is not consistent with what Brian and the police say happened. The trauma noted to her neck was done with so much force. How could it have been done by only leaning into the cord, not suspended around her neck and tied like a noose? What Kimberly learned from Dr. Jill Urban is that very limited information was sent with Amanda's body for autopsy, which contradicts Detective Jones's written report. For example, on May 20th, Jones stated, quote, "At about 21:45 hours, I received a call from the intake clerk of Southwestern Institute of Forensic Sciences, who gathered information for the doctor to conduct the autopsy on May 21, 2015. On May 21st, he wrote, "I spoke with the medical examiner, Dr. Jill Urban. I discussed in detail the investigation, and she advised that based on the information provided and her autopsy, that her official ruling was a suicide." Well, Kimberly and Justin spoke to Dr. Jill on the 22nd, the next day after the autopsy at 12 p.m., and Dr. Jill said she had not spoken to the detective or anyone from the police department. So, why did Detective Jones feel the need to write that he spoke extensively to her in his report? At this point, who can we even believe? Let's not forget that the Justice of the Peace told the family and hospital staff there would not be an autopsy because of her history of depression and alcoholism. It just seems someone involved was trying to spin a theory. This will be another subject that we will get to in part 5. I want to let you listen to a recording that is from 2018, but I feel it is important to hear at this point since we are discussing the autopsy. It's between Kimberly and Officer Nick Emmons. Also, in a second, I will discuss how I sent Amanda's pictures and autopsy information to a pathologist on my own. And I will discuss what that pathologist, who I will not name because I did not ask his permission, but I can read his statement regarding what he thinks by examining the photos and the autopsy report. First, I need to read to you a piece of Kimberly's blog, and this was a few months after May. She says, "There are so many things that don't make sense about this autopsy. It went back and forth between us, Sherman Police Department, and Medical Examiner's Office for 4 months. Our meeting with the Assistant Chief of Police in September ended with him promising to thoroughly look into the case. He told us he would personally call the Medical Examiner's Office and asked me to send him all of the pictures I had taken of Amanda immediately after, with all of her injuries and the day that she passed away, with the healing that had taken place." She goes on to say that he notes that he spoke to the medical examiner on September 30th, 2015. He said, "Dr. Urban again confirmed the findings described in the autopsy and added she was, quote, more sure since reading the report." He continues in his report to say, "And comparing the autopsy photos with photos taken and later provided by Kimberly Mullins, Amanda clearly had ligature marks and deep grooves around her neck. The clearly defined marks coincided with the skin folds in her neck and remained consistent to the back of her neck, consistent with hanging. Now, Kimberly says in her blog, the problems with this are, he told me at the conclusion of our meeting and on an email that he would get back to us within 2 to 3 weeks. After 3 attempts, it was clear he did not want to sit down personally and meet with us. It was only after I finally got the open record in May of 2016, when the case was officially closed, did I get to read his official statement. Dr. Urban said, quote, more sure since reading the report. What report? When did she read it? I thought the detective spoke to her extensively prior to the autopsy. Detective Jones states, quote, receipt of autopsy photos was initially delayed, therefore a second request was sent. He did not receive autopsy photos until February 1st, 2016. Kimberly says, yes, there were ligature marks in the autopsy photos, and my photos. They were not deep grooves. A deep groove is indication of hanging. There were not deep grooves. There was deep tissue bruising of the front strap muscles on both sides of the lower part of her neck and on one side of the back lower neck. There were abrasions and multiple levels of marks going horizontally. There are 2 marks going vertical, but the way the cord was tied to the rod, there is no way enough contact was made to make those abrasion marks. Nice try. This was the only place deep grooves was ever mentioned. The next page of Detective Jones' report really caught my eye because I noticed the things that he says and points out about Amanda and the things that he doesn't. Listen to this. Based upon my review of the case, my findings are as follows. Prior history. Amanda suffered from mental health issues and substance abuse for a number of years. Amanda was involved in a troubled and abusive relationship. Amanda was reportedly trying to leave the relationship but felt she had nowhere else to go. Amanda expressed some level of desperation and that she believed she had to be out of the house that evening. Evidence at the scene. Evidence at the scene indicated that Amanda may have been intoxicated at the time of the incident. Amanda's injuries were consistent with being hung by a thin ligature around her neck. The iron cord collected at the scene is consistent with Pierce's injuries. The photos depict injuries consistent with her reported body position. There were no other visible injuries or signs of a struggle. Now listen to this recording between Kimberly and Officer Nick Emmons from 2018 about the autopsy.
Just calling you back.
Yes, ma'am. How are you?
I'm good.
Do you have your... I'm sorry, I don't remember who it was on the phone with us as well.
No, it's just me. Just Kitty you. Cats. Yeah, my husband's not here.
We can meet in person if you want to. I was going to kind of describe for you what we did the other day and what we found and kind of where we're going to go from here.
Okay.
Based upon what we talked about. So what I did was we took the measurements from the closet and recreated the closet, basically just using 2x4s and a rod that was in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to list some of the what I... Correct me when I'm wrong. I'm going to list some of the concerns that I believe you had based upon what I was reading through the blog and just through the letter to the chief as far as about physical evidence. And so I think one of the concerns was that she would be able to actually cut through the extension cord with a razor blade. Somebody would not have been able to break that cord by pulling on it.
Mm-hmm.
That the knots did not actually sink up to the clothing bar as if weight was on it.
I didn't say that, but because I hadn't thought about that actually. If she was hanging, if it would have been tighter, I didn't think about that. But
okay. And that may have been the that may have come from the other. Associates that you'd contacted.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one was obviously the ligature marks.
Yes.
And so when we recreated it, what I did was I got a mannequin that was of similar height, and obviously I had not weighed because with the mannequin, obviously it's going to be light. And so just to recreate whether or not it would be possible to form the ligature marks that you were concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, they were an identical match to the ligature marks that are coming from the crime scene photos as far as the angle, the direction of both the ones that go back around the back of the neck plus the ones that ride up high. Now, the single one that you see that's lower that you're curious about that almost looks like it has a downward angle to you, I actually sent the photographs to another medical examiner and had them look at them and said, hey, can you tell me what could do this? And they basically said, based upon them, that is a symbol of an abrasion that could have had a shirt caught up underneath it or something like that. I'm just passing on what they told me, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't see anything out of just the photos to indicate that it was necessarily a homicide. And I left it pretty blank with them. I said, hey, I just need to know if you see something in here that would make you think this is a homicide. They did ask for the autopsy, and I sent them the autopsy information. So with the mannequin, as far as the ligature marks goes, they are consistent with what we found at the scene. So I'm going to move on to the second thing that we did was the concern with the cord, that it was long enough. That was the other one that y'all had expressed, that the cord would not, it was too long, I think, or I can't remember if it was too long or too short.
Too short to wrap around her neck that many times, and her to be sitting on her knees, like he said she was sitting on her knees praying, he said.
And so actually that is very clear that it was. Actually, the cord itself was a lot longer than what was originally told to me of 5 foot. It's longer than that. But based up create and make that where somebody could have done that to themselves. So when we switched over to the weight test, I did the same thing with the same cord and hung the weight that she would have been, which was about 114 pounds. So I hung the 114 pounds from a cord tied in the exact same manner of which it was tied in the photographs. And obviously stretched the cord out, and then I was able to walk over and actually just tug on it. And it actually did break when I pulled down on it, and it broke identical to what we saw in actually the real cord that I pulled out of evidence and looked at. And it's the exact same kind of consistent material and everything like that between the two.
Okay.
All that to say that the recreation shows that what we found and what the story is, that it is consistent with what we've told, what we've seen, and that some of the concerns that y'all have, clearly we were able to recreate in a controlled environment and do the exact same thing that we were told. one of the things that I am going to do still, that kind of the last thing that I'm going to do before I'm done looking at it again, is I'm actually sending the knife off. I think there was a concern about DNA and the knife and hers not being on it or his being on it. And so I wholeheartedly agree, and I'm sending that to the lab with her DNA to verify that her DNA is on the knife.
What's that going to prove? I mean, what's that DNA going to prove? Because it was in their house. It was a common knife in their house. They both could have used it otherwise. I mean, that's not going to prove anything to me.
I agree with you.
So don't spend your money on that.
It is just solidifying that her DNA was on the knife. Because the other realm would be, what if they come back and they were to say that it wasn't on there? Then that would be very alarming in my world.
Well, it was in their house. It was a common household thing in their house. So if it was on there, that doesn't mean she cut that cord with a blood alcohol of 382 and hung for over an hour and was still revived. I mean, you were there at the scene. You knew that she was warm to the touch, and he had been doing CPR on her for 15 minutes.
So you're going into the time frames. And you're trying to throw the time frames into the recreation scenario. The truth is, she could not have been hanging that long. You're right, and so that's out of this equation that I'm talking about right now. Is that the time frame that you're saying I'm not plugging into this equation right this minute?
Okay.
Because that's a different issue. But the truth is, when I look at that, I truly believe it was an error. And I don't think it was anything other than a misspeaking of time. And I don't have any way to substantiate anything different, but what I have is the forensic evidence that she was resuscitated to indicate to me, based upon a witness statement, that is saying that he went upstairs, immediately started screaming, and then said that he came running down, and then they were able to resuscitate her. And so to me, that's... no matter what they said verbally, that's really important fact in the case of how long she would have been hanging. What I don't have is I don't have a witness saying he got home an hour early, stayed around for an hour, then came down and drank with me, then went back up there, and then came down and did that. And I think that's what we're missing in there, is a statement of that. There isn't anybody that says that anywhere.
David said that he got home at 6 o'clock. David said it to me. He said it to the detective. He said it to you. He said it to everybody. He never came off of that 6 o'clock statement. Whether his time frame on how long Brian was up there with her, I think that's all relative, because I mean, he just said shortly after. Well, that's a very Brian said he got off of work. I mean, I know Brian got off of work at 5:15, and he said he went to the store and went straight home. That's not an hour and a half later. That's only a 10 or 15 minute drive. Anyway, like I told you before, I feel like Detective Jones falsified some of his stuff. He told me that's a very serious allegation, but he did. And
I'm sorry, what did you, I missed, you cut out on me there. You said what now?
I said that Detective Jones falsified some things in his report that didn't line up with the audio, and I don't know why he felt the need to do that, if he really thought it was a suicide.
I haven't really seen anything that I think is that. I guess I'm not seeing where you're saying that he's falsified or that it was anything other than what I've reviewed based upon it in the case. And unless I'm missing something, I am sorry, I just haven't seen that yet.
Well, listen to the Royal Case audio that he did with the lady and what he wrote in his report.
I know what you're saying, what he wrote, but you're hearing a small snippet of that where somebody... that's taking the conversation that they probably didn't talk before or after, and I suspect there's something in there that he wrote down in there that he had a conversation before or after. And I'm speculating on that. I hear what you're saying.
I talked to her personally, and she said that never came up, and she said she would testify in court against him. That never came up. So that's fine. I mean, that's fine.
Okay. Ultimately, what I'm going to do is, obviously, I'm sending the knife off. I filled out the lab submission for it now.
Please don't spend the county's money on that, because her DNA may be on it. It was her knife. It was his knife in that house. Don't spend the money on that. That's not going to prove anything to me at all.
Well, but it's not about proving it to you. What it proves is that if her DNA is not on it, and you're saying that in your mind there's an issue, well, then that would be something that has to be done. I am, based upon the test that we did here, everything is lining up as to what we've seen, and the marks, and everything is consistent with what the ME's are saying of a hanging, including all the abrasions and the actual color and everything like that is consistent, and it's consistent with the physical evidence of what her body would look like as to what he described. Also saying that the court, how it acted with the weight, is exactly what happened that day. And so based on that, I'm including that. I'm just going to do a concluding that into the report. One of the things that I know that you have said in talking to you is that you wanted this change to not be a suicide or listed as a homicide.
No, I just wanted the possibility of a homicide and looked at again from...
So ultimately, that's what I'm doing with it.
Okay.
And
I appreciate it.
Based upon everything that I'm finding, there's not going to really be anything else that we're going to be able to do with it at this time, based upon the evidence that we've had, the recreation, and just the forensic evidence that points to anything other than a likely self-inflicted injury.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time and looking over it. And if my husband wants to meet, if we want to meet up and just have you show us what you guys have come up with, that would be great. But I'll let you know.
Okay. And I'll be honest with you, you'll have to request that to the public information officer. As far as if you want to see the actual stuff that we've done, because I'm not going to, I won't. Part of this is, and it's just, this is me being truthful with you, is we tell you this information, and one of the things is that you took the information, which is your right, you have the ability to, and when you put it out on that blog like that, well, it's out there, right?
Yeah.
And so on the off chance that, say that it ever did, say there was something that showed up different than was, and it was to go to homicide, it's really easy for defense attorneys to attack it and say, well, this information is out there, and this is where it is. So that's one of the things that we try to do, is we try to keep the information. I know that it was probably Sergeant Smith at the time when he talked to him. He had actually was talking to you and said that we try to keep it as a limited venue as we can, so that when we find something that's out of the ordinary, it's a limited select pool of people that know it. And then when we interview them and they say something that we know that nobody else would know, it piques our interest, and that's where we start really honing in on the investigation. And so it's going to be an evidence. You can request it through the PIO, and I'm going to let them determine whether or not they'll actually release the recordings of us recreating the stuff. It does exist, so that'll be up to them and the Attorney General on what they're going to do with it.
So if it's a closed case, I may not have access to any of it? I mean...
So that's to be honest.
I mean, y'all closed it as a suicide, and y'all gave me the records in October in 2015. So it's closed as a suicide. So it's my information now. It's public.
Yes, you can absolutely request it and go the route to get it and view it. As long as they release it to you, that's entirely within your rights. That's what I'm telling you. You have every right to. But as far as me probably bringing it in here and actually showing it to you and doing all that I probably won't do that. But I'm more than willing to sit down with him and talk with him and explain this is what we've done. And I understand. I do. I know you probably don't think I do. I get it. But just based upon everything that I've done and everything's matching up to what I read through the autopsy, what I read through the report, what I've heard in the statements, and through the second opinion, there is nothing to me to indicate anything other than what we found. I'm telling you that I'm taking it a step further and I'm sending the knife off, but you're right. The odds of her DNA being on an item in her house is really high. Mm-hmm. It is.
So, I mean, they didn't want to pay for an autopsy because they didn't want to waste the county's money because it cost $10,000.
And it's not the county's money, though. That's just it. It's not the county's money.
Well, I'd rather you guys not. Please don't waste the money on my account because that's not going to prove one or way or the other. Their DNA may both be on there, but do what you need to do. I appreciate it. So if we came in to see you, you couldn't show me your recreation.
Out there in my review of what needs to be done is, I would love to re-interview this guy again.
I would too, but he's gone.
We're not going to find him.
I know where he's at, but anyway.
Are you saying Canada?
No, we're not saying Canada. He's illegal, so he's probably got a different ID and different social now and living here in Sherman. But
you think he's still living in Sherman?
I will tell you that I recorded him, a conversation with him, and I did that myself because Jeff Jones would not come to the hospital and talk to us. So I recorded him myself. If you want a copy of that, I would love to send it to you so you can listen to the ridiculousness of it. Anyway, I appreciate your time. I appreciate that. So if we came in, you couldn't show us the closet recreation and what you came up with. I mean, that would prove to me a lot if I could see it with my own eyes. Because that's what I paid forensic people to do.
I'm being honest with you. I am so hesitant to show you that because I am so concerned that you are going to take all that information and post it out there. And if I ever get a chance to interview this guy, and I can tell you that he has access to everything you put out there. You talked about the recordings, the interviews.
Absolutely.
And so, and that's you're right. I'm not saying it's not, but what I'm saying is that I'm real hesitant to give you any more information other than, I'm sorry you don't know me, you don't trust me, you may not believe me.
If that proves that it was a suicide, I don't think you should be afraid to share that with me. I think if that proves your point and you can show me how those ligature marks add up to that length of a cord and her sitting on her knees, not hanging, but sitting on her knees and causing those injuries, and if that would prove that to me, that would be an amazing step with me. It would be amazing, because that's why I pay a forensic person to do, was to recreate that, and it didn't come out that way. But on your part, I would be convinced if you could sit us down and show us exactly how it came up with.
My concern is that you're not going to be, and that's really because when I talk to you and I've told you about this, the first thing you go back to is something other than what the forensic evidence is showing. And so...
But you're telling me, you're not showing me. You're telling me how, I mean, I've been told a lot of stuff, but I want to be shown. That's my whole thing. Just show me, and that will convince me. You're telling me is not convincing me, but that's fine. I mean, you're entitled, but I will do an open records request so I can see your test. I can see you pulling the cord apart, and... I will do that. I will do an open records request, and I'll wait and go through the process like I've done for the last 3.5 years, but I don't mind.
I will reach out to my boss and ask him. He's going to be the ultimate say on whether or not I can show it to you.
Okay.
I can, I will set that up.
Okay.
But obviously, if he says no, then we're just going to go public information request. And like I say, sure. that's your right. You know, okay. I'm not trying to stop you from that. Because here's the issue. I know you say it's a closed case. And so here's where you get into that fine line of, I want to interview this guy again. I really do. Because part of your contention is the time frame. And so I agree, you can't change it in the reports. They say 6 o'clock or whatever in there. But what I know from doing my job for a long time, when I talk to people, is oftentimes they're wrong about that until you can actually give them a frame of reference. And so it could be, like you're saying, that, oh, he's lying. Or it could be that he just needed the frame of reference under a stress state and that they said it wrong because of that. And so I'm real kind of, you know, I told you I'm pretty neutral on that. I'm pretty neutral on that, on those statements. I've known people that have said wrong times in case after case after case after case, and we proved otherwise. So when I weigh in that I say what it looks like, I'm merely basing it upon forensic evidence that we recreated here, based upon what we did, and based upon a second opinion of the photos that you talk about, that you have with the ligature marks being concerning, of, hey, is there anything in this that makes you think suicide or homicide or either one or the other? And, you know, they say, no, there's nothing that would indicate one or over the other.
Who was the ME that looked at it? Where are they from?
They're from Collin County.
Okay.
So I went to a whole different organization.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that helps.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm trying to work with you. I really am. I can only imagine if this was my family, I know how hard it would be to, you know, because there's personal emotions in here, and you've got, I don't think anybody is denying that there's past abuse and things like that in there. So I'm just trying to work with you, and if he says that I can show him to you, I will call you back. I will set up a time.
Okay.
If it's set up a time, and I'll show you the images and the recreation.
Okay. So if you met with Brian again, what would that prove if he still denied it? I mean, does he have to confess to actually get him to look guilty, or?
Say that again, if I what?
You said you wanted to interview that guy again. I said if he confessed, is that the only way that y'all would?
Here's the thing with this. No matter what, with everything that you, your concerns, and you have said, the only thing that could ever, even when I talked to ME on this, there's really no evidence to make this be a homicide. And we could march in. So let's say this. I'm going to go extreme here with you on this. So let's say that something popped up, and we thought we had enough. We filed a case right now for homicide, right? Mm-hmm. And it went to court, and the defense would march in pathologist after pathologist after pathologist, forensic scientists, and all that in there to all say the same thing. These marks and these images don't indicate homicide. Even when coupled with circumstantial stuff, it does not equal homicide. And so we would never win a case like that because I get what you're saying about the knife and wasted money. But if I were to go the other way with it and I were to tell you that I have a knife that was supposedly used to cut the cord that was supposedly used to hang a lady, and her DNA is not on that, that is a really strong link, if that makes sense. That is a actual piece of evidence that's tangible that you go, there's no way to physically explain how her DNA could not be on it, so whose is on it? And so then we start going a different path. And so really what you're asking for is, even though you're telling me no, you're really asking for me to send that off. You just don't realize, you're not thinking it all the way through in the full process of where it could go. And mm-hmm. So for me, I believe it should have been sent off, and it needs to be done, and so I'm going to do it.
Okay.
Okay, and so I mean that is me really going out of the realm to tell you, hey, this to me is more important than anything else in this, is to go, if that knife were to come back and it said her DNA wasn't on it, that to me is the biggest red flag of the whole thing.
I can see that too. Yeah.
Okay, so if that makes sense to you, so
yeah, it does.
That's where I'm at with that. The reason I want to re-interview him is because I'm a believer in interviewing people in controlled environments. I believe in one-on-one interviews, and I think that when you do that, you get better indicators of deception and truth out of them. And I'm not saying he's lying, but I'm not saying that he's not. I'm saying forensic evidence, you know, shows that this happened. But much as you're asking me to show you the recreation, I want to see what this guy does when you ask him some provoking questions to see if I think he's being honest. And so if all this information is out there and all that goes out there, and I'm sure he'll probably never look at it, but he might, then I don't want the recreation getting out there, because so let's say that he did confess to doing something and all that's out there, then that is all for his defense and it's all for that, and it doesn't do us a bit of good. So that's just me really trying to keep a limited information flow out.
Yeah, I see that. And I backed off, you know, because, you know, I'm beating a dead horse, but I appreciate you doing that. And if you think of anything else, or if you need anything else from me, just let me know.
If obviously, no matter what, my boss says, I'm sure I'll either email you back. If he says no, if he doesn't, I'm going to call you, most likely. But I say all that to say that if you know where this guy is, I'd love you to tell me. If somehow you figure out where he is, I don't want you to go harass him, obviously, or do anything like that. But if somebody tells you or you have found out where he is and he's going under another name, please tell me. And that's part of what you're asking, is to relook at it. Well, to me, that is really what needs to be done. The last thing is another interview with him would be nothing but appropriate and beneficial in my mind.
Okay. Well, I will weigh that and get back with you, because I would like him re-interviewed. Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
I get it. I'm sure you're pretty defeated. I get it.
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
And another shitty thing, so...
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
Is this recent?
Yeah, it was Monday, so anyway.
Oh my gosh, I am so,
just
so sorry about that.
Another thing I'm having to deal with, but right now, you know, Amanda's case, I've got to put it on the back burner for a little bit, so.
Okay. Hey, so outside of being a cop, listen, I am a big fan of the Lord Jesus, and I know that he is the only one in my mind that can really... take care of any of these hurts and things.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I pray for you before I get off the phone?
Sure, that would be great. Thank you.
Hey, Lord God, we're coming to you today, Father. We are just really asking for you to just to intercede in this situation, God. Lord, we know this world is messed up and that there's a lot of pain, but God, or hurts and offenses back to a place, Lord, of healthy healing and a loving. God, I pray that you just to work this situation over for good, Lord, that you just surround her with your compassion, your peace and comfort, Lord, and you send the very people that are going to help to pick her up, Lord, just to hold her up and just to walk with her as she goes through this time, God. Lord, we know you love us. We know that you're a good God, Lord, and we just thank you today, Lord. I just thank you for just all the people that you are going to send to speak hope and love into her life at this moment. We thank you, Jesus, in your name. Amen.
Thank you.
I am so sorry. And if there's anything else I can do for you, please reach out to me, and I'm sure I'll be in contact with you, okay?
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
I'm sorry. I do. He's bullshit.
The pathologist I was in contact with said, quote, "I've got to agree that it really doesn't look good at all, and you have to wonder about ligature strangulation as opposed to hanging. What were the autopsy findings? Was there internal injury to the neck? Were there lots of petechia? As for the scene, could the cord have gone around the neck multiple times, or was it too short for that? How long between suspension and when she was found? Overall, and is often the case, The autopsy findings won't necessarily be definitive, but from what you've shown me, they certainly raise concerns. I would also be really impressed if he could break an electrical cord with his hands. Does he have injuries to his hands? And for that matter, if he did, could these not be an indication of him pulling on the cord while around her neck, maybe? So I sent the autopsy report, and he replied, quote, "The autopsy doesn't really help much, does it? An absence of petechia in the last sentence of the hanging paragraph would be unusual in ligature strangulation, but is common in hanging. Internal neck bruising is also more common in strangulation than in hanging. On the basis of the autopsy alone, I don't think you can really say which it is. That's not to say that there's suspicion here in that scene, and circumstances are often much more important than autopsy findings. Take as an example a contact gunshot wound to the head. On the basis of the autopsy, you can't say homicide, suicide, or accident, and I've certainly seen all three. Occasionally, you can have rope going around the neck multiple times in hanging, which is why I asked about cord length. For example, is it possible for the cord to have been secured in that way on the crossbar and still go around the neck three or so times? Or would it have simply been a short cord? At the time that I spoke to the pathologist, I didn't know that the electrical cord was not wrapped around her neck like a noose. So that's something that I wasn't able to talk to him about. But he recommended a book called Forensic Pathology by Vincent J. DiMaio and Dominic DiMaio, and it looks really interesting, so I probably will buy that. But the pathologist said it's basically suspicious circumstances, but it's not enough for him to say one way or the other. But he did say it deserves a proper investigation. So, moving on, a few days later, after speaking to Dr. Jill Urban, Kimberly and her husband had a follow-up meeting with the detective. Kimberly was able to capture 7 minutes of this meeting, and the rest are notes that I will read from the meeting after this recording.
That happened. We had no indications that it was a homicide.
Sure.
Also, you can't do an autopsy on a live person. She was still alive at that time.
Sure.
So she went to the hospital as still being listed as alive. And so the question of the autopsy didn't come about until after they determined that she was going to be brain dead. So that's when the question of the autopsy started coming about, and the judge started being contacted and all that by the hospital and district attorney.
Okay. At the scene, were pictures taken of the house, in the house,
yes,
the front porch, and all those things? So when you went into the house, the question of a bag has been a question. Did y'all take a picture of the bag that was downstairs?
Yes.
Can you tell us what color the bag was?
It was a small, like an overnight case, like hanging on top.
Was the contents inventoried?
No.
Okay. So we have that, and we inventoried the contents.
We have pictures of it.
And we have pictures of it, so when we opened it, we pictured of it. It's basically, so if you, I would encourage you to, I don't know if you're married or not, or to ask a wife or other ladies, you know, what do you typically take when you're trying to leave or go somewhere for just a night or to meet it? And it's the contents of the bag. So it's
hair supplies.
The bag,
hair supplies, it's makeup, her Bible, her wallet.
Kids' pictures.
Kids' pictures, those essentials of basically leaving. That type of things.
Blood I did drive. A follow-up investigation on that bag specifically because that was one thing brought into question. Mm-hmm. There was no other bags packed in the house or anything.
Correct.
Else. But that bag, talking to the people at Royal Case where she works, that she brings that bag to work with her every day. And they don't know if she carries her lunch in it or what, but that's the bag she carries with her every day to work. And she has all of her stuff in it.
And that's very potential. We're not disagreeing with that. So the
a lot of witnesses that we know her. She just carries a wallet back and forth to work. That she goes to the gas station for lunch. That
she takes her wallet. The wallet was in that carrying case, and the wallet was in a carrying case because she called me that day and talked to the individuals. The phone number that she was given that day
For Amber?
For Amber was a new number that she didn't have before, was written in that wallet. So we know that wallet was with her at the time of making the phone calls, and in that, and it was packed in there.
And her bank card was missing out of it.
Bank card's missing. But it did have her Social Security card and essential, you know, basically, I'm taking my essential things, you know, Bible, pictures of my kids, my wallet.
Hair dryer, hair curtain, makeup.
So it wasn't a work or a lunch bag that day. I'm not saying that the same bag was not. Okay. And in the room, I guess, I mean.
Waver Brown thought it was awkward that it was downstairs.
He told us that without us prompting that, that he said, you know, and yeah, there's a bag downstairs when we came, and I don't know why that bag was down there.
And I asked him, did you have a fight? And he said, no, we didn't fight. You know, we went to bed, which is a lie because Dustin said that Amanda told him he stole $100 from her that night. That's when he told her to get out by 7 because they fought that night.
Yeah, I spoke with Dustin on the phone about that.
You know, part of the questions that Amy said, and I don't know if you had told us this as well, that, you know, one reason they ruled it a hanging and not a strangulation was that she had no defensive type marks, scratches on her neck, pulling at cords or anything like that. So part of the conversation that you've been told and that we've been told and all the times that we've been told was without any prompting, it was told prior to them knowing how she was in the hospital, was that he made statements that day that if she was not gone, that I will choke you and kill you when I got home. That's what her comments were to her friends. That told us before we talked, and we reviewed that before, and that he liked to sit on her hands or hold her hands back so she couldn't fight and strangle her. So
choke her out.
So you wouldn't see the marks on her neck from pulling at it if his arm was in place. My question is to you, did y'all take pictures of him?
Yes.
Of his arms and hands and stuff like that?
Yes.
Any scratches?
No.
Nothing there at all. So, you know, part of it is, you know, the statement, again, not my statement, her statement to other individuals, more that you could verify to
somebody
Amber,
out and
Dustin, that she's okay with getting hit, but can't stand it when he holds her down and chokes her out and can't fight. So that eliminates the question.
All the people I've talked to, I've gotten mm-hmm. parts of what you're saying, mm-hmm. but some of the stuff is news because none of them told me this. Oh, sure. Sorry, I had to borrow your office real quick.
But that's why I'm saying this is that. We didn't prompt this, and we weren't alone when these people said these things to us, because it was like, that's what brought us most of the fact that, you know, again, has Amanda done things before? Bad choices, absolutely. Could she do something stupid like this before? Yes. But in this case, it's not the case. And nothing, of course, I know you're getting the feeling, nothing you're going to say is going to change our mind that we feel this way, because there's too many things, and we'll go through the rest of the list, and I'll show you where. And you've done this much more than I have, and you may have already answered all these questions, but we want to know these things as well to help us. Nothing to buy.
Did the ligature go, the cord go with her to the medical examiner's office?
No, it didn't. We talked to him on the phone about it. I told him to describe the cord to him, told him what it was, and they said, okay, if we need it, we'll call and request pictures of it.
So, do y'all still have it? Is, like, the knot, I mean, is the knot still in it and everything? That's kind of what we want to know. You know, how was it knotted up to where such abrasions were on her neck?
I'll explain to you how it was done. Threw it over her shoulders, crisscrossed it, mm-hmm. tied the knot. So as the body weight goes down, it acts as a pinch collar. It tightens up as further the body goes down, which even if you do it slightly, the vascular area right here, we are trained in a certain chokehold, it's called the lateral vascular chokehold. Only a few seconds of the cord being right here can cause you to lose consciousness and sink further into it, and then it starts shutting off everything else. So
she couldn't have been hanging more than 10 minutes, 8 minutes. How can she get that many abrasions on her neck and not have any hemorrhages in her eyes or any hemorrhages in her face or her mouth?
Don't know. I'm not a medical expert. That's what the ME's office was
doing. I mean,
I've worked several cases over the years where I've found people that have hung themselves and they could have very easily stood up at any time and have walked away from it. But either they chose not to, or they actually passed out sooner than they expected and couldn't recover from it. So
all the circumstances around this, is it not even feasible that he could have hung her at all?
Detective Jones said that he took pictures of Brian at the scene, but there were none found in evidence. Yet again, he denied knowing anything about Brian having outstanding warrants and a history of being a domestic violence abuser. He told Kimberly and Justin that if they were not satisfied, they could file for open records. Kimberly and Justin asked Detective Jones why Dr. Jill Urban told them she had not spoken with him or anyone from the Sherman Police Department. His response was that he didn't know why she was lying because he claims he spoke extensively with her. His report says they spoke for about 3 hours after the autopsy. Also, Dr. Jill did not have any photos of Amanda that were taken immediately before or after she was taken to the hospital. Of course, Amanda healed a lot during the 6 days that she was on life support. On May 28th, Justin wrote Detective Jones and said, "Jeff, it is just so hard to believe with the information that you have, you can honestly say homicide is not an equal possibility that warrants that type of investigation. No phone records or text messages have been checked yet. No fingerprints have been checked on the iron or the box cutter, which one of those alone could possibly only have Brian's prints. That is a chance, and if that turned out, then you have the evidence. No one but Brian saw her hanging. No one. But that is who you are believing. How intense has David been interviewed? Remember, David is Brian's co-worker and lives downstairs from Brian and Amanda. I do not see a reply to this email. If I'm wrong, I will be happy to come back and let you all know if there was a reply to this email, but I am not seeing it." Kimberly also wrote on the same day that she spoke to Amber at 10:45 that morning about Brian's supposed attack that left him injured and not able to go back to work after Sunday, May 17th. This is about when Amber and Crystal and another girl named Krista, who are all friends with Amanda, went and confronted Brian. She goes on to say that Amber said they did not touch him. Her friend Krista spit in his face and kicked his shin, and then he promised that he didn't hurt Amanda. He told Amber, Crystal, and Krista that the bruise on Amanda's chest was from falling off a ladder while changing a light bulb the week before, which we know to be untrue, because Amanda told Mrs. Thompson herself that she was used as a punching bag. Now, she goes on to say that Mrs. Thompson from next door said that there was a lot of yelling but no hitting. You are welcome to call Amber, Krista, or Crystal to verify that story. Were the police called to that disturbance on May 17th? Just want to find out where the report of his injuries were documented. Or has he just not shown back to work and it's assumed? This email that I just saw is from May 21st, and it is from Kimberly to Detective Jones, and it says, "Another thing, that night we spoke with you in the waiting area, 3 Mexican men walked out of her room. We asked who they were very intimidating. The nurse told us that they and her boyfriend said Amanda did not have any family, that we had put her away in a mental hospital, which is what he always told her that we would do if she ever came to us for help. And we took away her children and wouldn't allow her to see them. All lies, but Phil, he tried to keep us out of the room that night. Every time we went to get and help her, she would be terrified and ready to leave. But she always went back and said that they would work it out, and she was more afraid to go to the hospital. The time I mentioned she had taken pills, she had left a note and called me to tell us she loved us and please tell the boys that she loved them. She became scared and said that she didn't want to die. I told her to throw up and drink water. I told Brian to take her to the hospital, but he said that she was okay. I told him I was calling 911, and he said they were on the way to the hospital. He lied. They never went. I will download recording and text messages between us that night. So if we go by Amanda's past, like the detective and the police department want to harp on this one time that Amanda possibly took pills or was coerced to take pills, whatever the situation was, she left a note and she wanted her children to know that she loved them, and then she realized she was scared to die and didn't want to die. Does that part not matter? This will wrap up part 4. In part 5, and possibly 6, I want to go over all the false statements and lies in Detective Jones's reports, undisputed facts, discrepancies in Brian's statements, where he is, what was done as far as investigating the scene, a few more meetings, the poorly performed reenactment of the scene that will blow your mind, and the newest updates, as well as some very interesting and disturbing information that I found when doing my own digging about Grayson County officials and people that work alongside them, especially on cases of possible homicides that were ruled suicides by Dr. Jill Urban. You can always make those phone calls and emails to the DA Brett Smith and the others that are in the show notes. Let them know that we will not stand for this injustice, and Amanda Pierce's case deserves to be reopened, reinvestigated, and for them to be able to say they actually did everything that they possibly could, because at this point, they have not, and they have failed Amanda. Thank you for listening to this episode. Until next time, stay safe and take care.